Jesus, we welcome your presence as we arrive and bring you with us. You weren't existing in this room a few hours ago, but where two or three come together, we bring the presence that abides with us, your indwelling presence. We bring you with us, and corporately, you do something in these environments that you don't do when we're by ourselves. And we don't fully understand what that means, but we know that you delight in the worship of your people. And even as we talk with one another, we are responding and having opportunity to respond to you. So I pray this morning that we would be in tune with your presence, that we would hear your voice, even as you take a thought and apply it specifically to something that deals with us, to me personally, but also that we would be attuned to those around us and that we would be plugged in to what other people are experiencing and hearing and feeling as we open our mouths and share, because that is also part of the learning experience. So help us, we pray this morning, to be better worshipers than we were before we were here. And we'll give you the praise because ultimately it is the work of your Spirit in us that will make that happen. And we give you glory in your name. Amen. All right, well, here's where we've been. We've been talking about worship, particularly worship being more than music. Real quick story. I got invited to be a part of the staff meeting at Matthew's Church last Monday morning, which was fun. Felt a little bit like work, but it was fun. But they had an event this past Wednesday night. It was sort of a picnic cookout type thing, but it was also a prayer gathering. And they were all coming together at the pavilion in a park to do this. And as I was listening in staff meeting, I heard them say, "Who's going to do worship?" My ears picked up. And of course, what were they really saying? Who's going to play the instruments and sing? And that's exactly what they were talking about. And I didn't chastise them because I'm growing just like they're growing. But it was interesting to me that so often that's exactly what we do. We think of worship as music. And we could have had worship at a picnic without any music at all. We could have had a response to God that was triggered by his word or by a testimony or by a prayer or conversation, scripture reading corporately, whatever. But it's interesting that so often we associate it. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to see that worship includes music, but it goes way beyond that. And if we figure that out, when we do come together and have the musical worship part, it's going to so enhance our experience of God. So that's what we've been after. And right now we're at a point where we're looking at one of the problems, one of the obstacles that we need to deal with, and that is us. If you were with us a couple weeks ago, we broke out this really heavy $5 word, and we said, part of our problem in worship is that by nature, we are narcissistic. And you say, what is narcissistic? Well, I can break it down into a 25-cent word for you. Narcissism is me at the center of everything. Now, in case you're wondering, you're narcissistic. So am I. We all are. It's a universal problem. We're born that way. And it doesn't help that when we're born, for the first months of our lives, all the attention is given to us, and all we need to do to get somebody to pay attention to us is what? Cry. We open our mouth. We get fed, we get changed, we get clothed, we get naps. It's a great life. But we are transformed into this life with this idea, hey, this is pretty cool. It's all about me. In fact, one of the hardest things to do as a parent is that first night that your kids are in bed, they're in their crib, and they're crying, and you so want to go in there and do something and talk to them and hold them, and the pediatrician says, no, you need to let them cry themselves to sleep. They need to break away from this idea that it's always all about them. This is not healthy. So we're trying to, and you know, and then you get to kindergarten and you go, whoo, here I am, I'm in kindergarten. And you go, wait a minute, it's not all about me. There's 27 other kids in this room. But we carry that with us everywhere in life but particularly when it comes to worship. So we're already battling this issue that when we think about worshiping God and we say God needs to be the focal point of our worship. Well, yeah, that makes sense. Why would that be a difficult thing? Why would that be a big deal? Well, the big deal is this, because our natural posture is that I am at the center of it and that it all hinges on whether I benefit from it, enjoy it, appreciate it, like it, feel good about it, all those things. You know, it's really hard to ignore when an entire row of good-looking people walks in and sits at your feet while you're teaching. I'm sorry, I wasn't going to acknowledge it, but it's pretty cool. Narcissism, see? How that impacted me. Woo, love it. All right, but here's the payoff. How do I know if narcissism is affecting my worship? Well, there's two things. Narcissistic worship looks like us knowing less and less about God. Corporately, the reason that learning about God is important is because it directly contradicts the narcissistic aspect of me being at the center, and it puts God at the center. But I can only have God at the center if I know something about him. So I need to, remember 2 weeks ago? I need to be looking at those verses that say, God is all powerful, God is all present, God is loving, God is gracious, God is merciful, God is forgiving. I need to be focused on those things because that act, that discipline, moves God to the center of worship and moves me out of the center. When we are worshiping in a narcissistic way, very little knowledge about God is being presented. You say, well, if that happens, what's in its place? Anybody want to guess? What is the dominant word in worship today corporately? Not necessarily music. Yeah. The dominant word today is emotions. It's not enough that we worship God and have an encounter with God. The dominant thing when it's all about me is that there have to be emotions involved. I have to feel something. Why? Because it's me. And that really is a way of putting me at the center. So I go into a worship service and I walk away and I go, yeah, I didn't really feel that. That's okay. It wasn't about me in the first place. In fact, someone came up to Francis Chan recently and said, I didn't get anything out of that worship service. And his response to them was, that's okay. We weren't worshiping you. Yeah, Francis Chan can get away with that. I can't. We have made this the litmus test for whether a worship experience is really good. It doesn't have to be that way. There is an intellect aspect that often gets discounted, but we can encounter God with our minds, independent of emotion. But when intellect is not presented, when we're not being taught about God, we're just saying, there's God, be excited about him. If that's how we measure it, that's a pretty good clue that we are at the center of our worship experience. Now, the other thing is, When narcissism is the word of the day, instead of faith being at the center of our worship experience, which, by the way, the author of Hebrews says, without faith it is impossible to please God. Instead of faith being at the center, it's replaced by feelings. One of the clues, if you're in it, don't judge a church by one Sunday. That's really not fair. That's like judging a restaurant by one trip. You got to make multiple trips before you can evaluate a restaurant. But one clue in whether narcissistic worship is beating out faith, one clue is this. Are you being asked to do anything that makes you feel uncomfortable? Are you being stretched out of that place where you feel secure, you feel safe, you feel you've got this? Is anything going on in the service that stretches you to a place where you go, whoa, I'm not in control. I don't feel like I'm in control of this. I don't feel like I know what's going to happen. Now, a few years back, we did something that was so horrible and rotten and bad that we had to publicly apologize for it. Because it was that bad. It was heinous, sinful, from the pit of hell. We eliminated from the bulletin the order of service. We just took it out. For a whole year, we took it out. We had a half sheet. Some of you are old timers, you remember this. We had a half sheet. On the one side was announcements, which were required by our Constitution to have. You can't have a church service without announcements. I thoroughly believe when we get to heaven, the first thing that we're going to hear is, you may enjoy eternal bliss forever, but first, we have a few announcements, because every other gathering of Christians I've ever been in has been like that. But you know what? People went nuts. We got more emails about not having the order of service in the bulletin than we had gotten the previous year about lost people or about missions or about budgets or about bylaws or anything like that. We had people that were like, this is, oh no, you can't have this. Why? Because when you got the order of service, you're in control. You know what's coming. You know when the next song's going to be. You know, when the sermon wraps up, you know that we're getting close to the end. You know that, and there's a sense of control about that. And I like that. When I go to a church, I do the same thing. I like to know, when's this going to be over? We like to have that feeling of being in control, and when in worship something happens that isn't in the bulletin, and we've got to trust God for it, it makes us a little crazy. Now, different people grow up in different denominations, and so some people are more used to this than others, and I understand it's a tradition. I grew up in a church where if someone raised their hand in worship, we thought they had a question, because we just didn't do that. I was in college before I encountered a person who was raising their hands in worship. I didn't understand what it was about. So naturally, that which I didn't understand, I labeled as wrong. What is going on there? That is just wrong. Why did they have to do that? It was just something new that I had never encountered before. Sometimes when Holy Spirit moves in an unexpected way, it freaks people out. We don't know what to do with it. Because we're being asked to trust God for something that we've never encountered before, we've never seen before, that we don't understand. And it makes us feel uncomfortable. So someone stands up and starts to pray. Someone stands up and starts to confess. Someone stands up and starts to do something that we've never seen anybody do in church before. Good grief, they're kneeling. That's when we know that it's too much about us. Can you imagine what it was like in the early church when Holy Spirit moved and these 12 disciples who had grown up in a situation in a Judeo-ethic where you didn't see stuff like that. That was not their norm. They had a temple they worshiped in, and it had a room for this and a room for that, and there were lines that you could go across, and everything was sort of under control. And all of a sudden, tongues of fire are appearing, and people are speaking in tongues, and they weren't used to that. They were being asked to be stretched by God. So in worship, when you have an encounter, and your first thing is, this isn't moving me, that's okay. It doesn't have to. And I'm not feeling comfortable, that's okay. Because often when God is at the center, the first thing he wants to do is take the legs out from under us and rob us of that sense of control. All right, so that's the ramp up to what we're going to do. But today, you picked a good day to be here. I am so excited about this. All right. Today, we are going to talk about idols. And this all flows out of what we just covered, so it's okay. We're going to talk about three words that we'll be repeating often. And this is just one of those things where maybe this won't strike you. Maybe this won't make you feel comfortable. But this was life-changing for me. I read a book 2 years ago before it was actually printed. And it just was so powerful. And then when I went to council 2 years ago in Columbus, I got to talk with the author and tell him about it. And we've maintained a communication about it. It just was so helpful to put into words an experience that I had had. Here's where we start. A professional football player takes almost an entire day during the course of the week between games to do one thing, to study films. He looks at film of previous games against that particular team that he's going to be playing. And when he studies those films, and these films are usually shot from a camera that is well above the television angle, so you can see the entire field and get perspective on it. But football players watch films during the course of the week for one reason: to pick up tendencies of the other team. Oh, on third down, they have a tendency to run to the right. They like to throw the ball on first down. That's a tendency. So that when a defensive player is on the field and it's a certain situation, he can react and understand what is likely going to happen. Historically, our capacity to worship God properly has been hampered by one thing: idols. But in order to understand idols, we need to understand where idols come from. Idols are manifest expressions of our deep infatuation with ourselves. So we've talked about narcissism and worship. That when we enter into worship, it tends to be, at least at the outset, about me. Idols are born out of that soil. Idols grow out of our deep infatuation with ourselves. God has always had a plan for his people to worship him and worship him alone. Anybody think of a commandment that might have that stated in it? Help me out. The first one, yeah. And what's it say? Anybody want to read it? Exodus 20. No other gods. You know, the objective person looking at that goes, well, that's a little bit egotistical. That'd be like me saying, hey, no other pastors. I want you, no other preachers. I don't want you going online. I don't want you downloading other people's sermons. Only mine. You go, whoa, boy, he's got a big head. But when God says that, we know God doesn't have an ego. He's got a reason for it. And the reason is, he loves us and cares about us, and he understands that if we go looking elsewhere for an object to worship, we're going to be disappointed and often hurt. He designed a system in which no other thing will fulfill us in the same way as true worship of him. That is not by accident. He designed it. So the good things in life that are not, they're not evil things. We're not talking about evil things, although that also fits the category. The good things in life will never do for you what God designed himself to do for you. Now hear that. The good things in life will never do for you what God himself designed to do for you. Can anybody give me an example of a good thing that ultimately will not fulfill you the way God fulfilled you? Your spouse. God never intended for marriage to meet my needs the way that he can. Another one? Money. Money's not bad. People say money is the root of evil. No, it's not. The love of money is the root of evil. Another one? Work. You're on a roll. Give me two more. Food. Food is good. Love food. Pleasure. Yeah. Notice no one brought up grandchildren. Grandchildren won't do it either. Sex won't do it. That car, that truck, that career, that house, none of those things. And God designed it intentionally that way. It's not just a happenstance. God designed it that way. There is one key and one key only that ultimately unlocks the door. Now, I have a key to the church in my pocket. I also have a key to my office and a key to the dumpster. Those are the three things that I use most often, so I pulled them off my keychain so that I can have them. But if I want to get into my office, there is only one key. And if I try to use this key to get into my office, it will not work. But I can get in using this key. It was designed so that only this key will unlock the door. God has designed himself in the very same way to be the only key that unlocks fulfillment of my soul. That's not an accident. He did that on purpose. From the very beginning of humanity's story in Genesis, we are trapped by the lie that something else other than God is worthy of our worship. Collectively, these things are known as idols. Some are material items that can be seen and handled. Others are created in the human heart and mind. They have no tangibility, but they all represent worship that is taking place toward the wrong thing. God never designed for me to worship my spouse. He never designed me to worship money, to worship a career, to worship a person, or even an idea. Material items that you mention are cars and houses and clothes and phones and boats and technology and money, and you can just go on and on with the list. But there are also experiential things that we are prone to worship, like sex and food and adrenaline and competition and time and pleasure and sports and fame and knowledge and approval and power and companionship and work. There's a whole long list of things that you can't pick up and hold in your hand, but they're very real. And to add to the list, there are concepts that we are prone to worship. Beauty, security, comfort, tradition. You know someone who worships tradition, and maybe it's you. But at the very least, you know someone who, when you say, but this is our tradition, we've always done that, you go, wow, they really put a lot of stock in that tradition. Body image for women is a huge idol, even though it's an unrealistic one. Many women worship an image that is airbrushed, and they can never achieve it, but they aspire to it. For men, the idol is more masculinity. There's an image, there's a concept of what it means to be masculine, and they pursue that and try to find it. Greed, jealousy, selfishness are all idols that we have a tendency to worship. So it can be material things, it can be experiential things, it can be conceptual things. Now here's our problem. When we use the word idols, what happens? Where does your mind go? Honest. Some little Cupid doll that a group of people in a hut in some jungle are bowing down to. We project that is an idol. And they shouldn't do that. And we know they shouldn't do that. They should worship God. We understand that. But we often fail to see ourselves in the same relationship with other things that are much closer to home and much more real. So we can be worshiping security, and in our minds, be doing everything we can to produce security. And we don't even see it. We can be blind to it. The Apostle Paul, when he was at Athens in Acts chapter 17 and verse 16, said this, "While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. And he said, people of Athens, verse 22, people of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious, for as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription to an unknown God. So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I'm going to proclaim to you." They were worshiping an unknown God, and Paul said, you know what? You're worshiping something, and you're ignorant of what it is that you're worshiping. That is so true. The things that we have a tendency to worship, we're not even aware that we're worshiping. Holy Spirit, open my eyes and show me the things that I'm worshiping. So what do we do with all this? Biblical idols were demanding and bloodthirsty. I mean, when you worshiped a biblical idol, it demanded a great deal from you. What's the ultimate expression in Old Testament history of what an idol demanded of the people that were worshiping it? Sacrifice your children. Now, is that counterintuitive? Parents? You, all right, be honest. Some days? No. Yeah, okay. Here. I mean, that is what we value, our children. But the demand of the idols that were being worshipped was so great and the impact was so blinding that they were handing off children as sacrifices. Contemporary idols are exactly the same. Our contemporary idols that we fall into the trap of worshiping are every bit as demanding. They demand much from us, and they make promises that they don't keep. So fill in the blank. If I take possession of this, it will do this for me. That's the lie of the idol. So how's that look in real life? Give me one. If I take possession of coffee, it will. Okay, good one. Problem? You coffee drinkers are going, I see no problem whatsoever. I'm good. Yeah, the problem is, it's temporary. Any other problem that you're aware of? Yeah. Yeah. Is it inherently wrong to drink coffee? No. Especially if it's sanctified. But where will it let you down? It will let you down in that it's only going to last for a while and then you are going to need more. And more, biologically, literally means the impact will be less and less. It's going to take more caffeine, it's going to take more coffee, it's going to take more to achieve the same result than it did a year ago. It also is utterly dependent. Now, I'm not picking on anyone in my family because I know enough not to drop any names. But I've been told by a member of my family that if they were to go completely off coffee, they would have a massive headache that would last for a couple of days. But they're not dependent on it. With dependency comes pain. Please understand, I'm all kidding aside, I'm not knocking coffee. I'm just trying to point out a principle here is that even something as good and as simple as a cup of coffee has the capacity to become an idol that I have to bow down to. And isn't it interesting that in this culture, we look at people who are injecting heroin into their arms and go, that's just terrible. And we do it while we're sitting in Starbucks drinking this huge coffee for $45, going, I can't believe that someone could become so addicted to a drug. We don't see it. We don't see it. And then there are physical issues that accompany it that we often are blind to. We don't see. All right, let's wind it up and try again. Exercise. Let's phrase it this way. If I take possession of physical fitness, it will okay. Any issues?
Some time ago, right in my neighborhood,
Yeah, it can be very self-centered. I have to look this way. Why? So that she'll like me, he'll like me, so that, what's the reason behind it? It can be pure, it can be, I'm building up my heart so that I don't have a heart attack, but it can also be very vain. It's temporary in nature. Okay, the Bible endorses exercise, by the way. Physical fitness is good, but it also points out that it's not a long-term solution to anything. It can be self-centered. What else?
It can replace other activities that, you know, maybe time to
run. Right. Right.
It can be used out of fear of pain and fear of pain. You can't exercise your way out of getting cancer or getting old, or it's not a way to save yourself. It can save you some troubles, but it can't rescue you forever. It's not a constant savior.
Per Dave's right. Neighbor, right. Yeah. So John? Knock it off, man. You're really starting to irritate me with all this running that you're doing. Look at that and I go, man, I get tired driving 26 miles. This guy runs 26 miles. It doesn't seem to be right. We could go down the list and we won't beat it to death. We can go down the list. But these things are not inherently bad, and I'm not advising that we never do them. I'm not against drinking coffee and I'm not against exercise. But the reality is, the incomplete joys of this world will never satisfy the heart. They weren't designed to. So you can reach that place of ideal weight and ideal BMI, and you can reach that place of absolute being alert and awake, and it still isn't going to deal with that wound in your soul that only God can heal and that only He can satisfy. So what we're looking at is keeping things in perspective, but it's not just any perspective, it's God's perspective. Now, this is only going to mean something to some of you, and it doesn't mean anything to me, but I'm going to read this because it sounded good. I kid you not. The central plot device in The Lord of the Rings is the Dark Lord Sauron's Ring of Power, which corrupts anyone who tries to use it, however good his or her intentions. The ring is what Professor Tom Shippey calls a psychic amplifier, which takes the heart's fondest desires and magnifies them to idolatrous proportions. The wearer of the ring becomes increasingly enslaved and addicted to it, for an idol is something we cannot live without. Never seen Lord of the Rings, but if you're a Lord of the Rings person, maybe that means something to you. It enslaves us. It's not a bad thing, but over time, it begins to get a grip on us, and now instead of it serving me, I'm serving it. You know that a car can be that way, and you know that a relationship can be that way, and you know that a house can be that way, where it starts out, isn't it wonderful that I have this, and instead, it has me. And now I'm giving more and more attention to serving it. John Calvin said, man's nature, so to speak, is a perpetual factory of idols. This isn't theory. This is our corporate reality. We don't need to think about, I wonder if there are idols. There are idols. They are seeking to enslave us. And we need a strategy for worship that doesn't say, you know, if I ever had an idol, this is what I would do. And instead says, Lord, show me the idols so that I can divest myself of being controlled by them and put you at the center instead of me. Idols flow out of my narcissistic nature. Gwen. Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And
Right. Yes. And to follow up on that, I think that's an excellent observation, Gwen. To follow up on that, how do I typically deal with your idols? They're not mine, but they're yours. How do I typically respond to your idols? That's right. That's absolutely right. Read your Bible and pray more. Right. This is so simple. Why are you enslaved by this? I don't get it. It's how I deal with the alcoholic. I've never been tempted to drink. And so the alcoholic is in a situation, and I'm very quick to point out, it's of his own making. No one forced him to do it. Oh, that's great. That's also very ungracious, saying your idol has control of you. That would never happen to me. And so it's very easy for me to judge someone else's idol. Right. But I can get on my wife about her coffee drinking all day long because that hasn't been, isn't, and will probably never be an idol for me. So I can be really straightforward and blunt and just bang her over the head in a, you know, not that I would ever do it in a public setting or anything like that. But I can question that and say, I just don't get it. Why are you so drawn to that? It's easy for me to do that until somebody brings up the topic of books. Books. Books or tea, right? Yeah, there's caffeine in tea. Not nearly as much, though, right? Not nearly as much. So what is an idol? Anything more important to you than God. Anything more important to you than God. That's an idol. In Ezekiel 14, verse 3, the elders of Israel got into a bad place, and Ezekiel said, these men have set up idols in their hearts. It doesn't have to be a physical object that you're bowing down to. It can be a concept. It can be an idea. If we just had more room in this house, we would be such a happier family. That can be an idol. If I just had a spouse, I'm single, if I just had a spouse, my car has 200,000 miles on it. If I just had a new car, I'd be more secure when I'm driving late at night. Security can become an idol. At all, I gotta have this. And may I say it? When it comes to corporate worship on Sunday, song selection can be an idol. I've got to have my contemporary music. I've got to have my drums. It isn't worship if I don't have drums. Some people feel the same way about traditional hymns. It isn't worship unless it's got that. And we can create an idol out of something as wonderful and sacred as music when we say this is more important than God. Because of our proclivity toward idol worship, we need to approach this topic not as if I had a tendency to worship idols mindset, but which ones, Lord, which ones? Show me. Nuts are not bad for you. Unless you have a nut allergy, then they can destroy you. We are allergic to everything. Everything has the potential to kill us. Good things that we would never put into a category of evil have a capacity to destroy us. Church can be an idol. History can be an idol. Tradition can be an idol. Language and culture can be idols. Fear can be an idol. Which leads us to the formula. This is my favorite part of this. And how much time do we have? Good, we got time to get into it. We won't get through all the way through, but I just think this is exciting. How do we deal with this? I don't want to leave you with just saying, you've got idols, bad, bad, bad. Let's close in prayer. All right? I don't want to do that. How do we deal with idols? Okay. The first step is this. Three words. Write these down because we're going to use these. Orientation. That's word one. Orientation. Word two, disorientation. Word three, reorientation. This is a formula. This is going to plug in to idols across the board. Orientation, disorientation, and reorientation. The first word is orientation. What is orientation? It is the determination. This is going to sound, this is another $5 phrase here. The determination of the relative position of someone or something. What? The determination of the relative position of someone or something. Our orientation right now in this class is that we are all on level ground. Right? So when you come in and you sit down and you're looking at another person and I'm looking at you and you're looking at me, we're all on level ground. But if you came in to this room and you had an inner ear infection that was causing you dizziness, even if you are seated, it would be possible for the room to be spinning and you would be disoriented. Have you ever woken in a hotel room and forgotten where you were, like what city you were in? We just spent like 5 nights in 4 different hotel rooms in the past week while we were traveling. And you wake up in the middle of the night and it's dark and you go, am I in Kansas City or am I in St. Louis? Where am I? I need to think for a second about where I am. That's, we refer to that as being disoriented. For a second, I'm not even sure where I am or what time it is. That can also be disorienting. Reorientation is the process of getting back to the right place of orientation. So let's dive into this. Orientation begins with how we see ourselves in relationship to the world around us. How we see ourselves in relationship to the world around us. Quick illustration, hopefully can make the point briefly. When you see someone on television that says they are fighting for rights, 99.9% of the time, whose rights are they fighting for? Their own. That's right. I was watching a baseball game last week, and I saw a manager storm out of the dugout and get into the face of the umpire. And I didn't have to have the volume on to know that he was arguing a call that went against his team. I have very rarely seen a major league manager come out of the dugout, get in the face of the umpire and said, that call was horrible and it cost the other team dearly and you need to do something about it or I'm going to kick dirt on you. That's not our orientation. Be honest, our orientation is we love our kids a lot. Other people's kids, they're annoying. We love our kids. But man, we are so quick to look at other people's kids and go, look at that, they're out of control. Why don't they ever discipline them? Because that's how we're oriented. We're oriented that this belongs to me and I love this dearly. This is over here and I don't have the same feeling and so I react differently to it. That's part of our orientation. We are oriented to be selfish. When people go to the polls, they're always polling people on how they're going to vote. When people go to the polls and they say, what is the number one issue facing America? How do people answer that question? Don't give me the issue. That's not what I'm asking for. The thing that affects them or the thing that they think is the most important issue. That's the filter that everything goes through. Yeah, most of the time it's what impacts me personally. So if I'm a gun owner, that's a big issue for me. And if I'm an immigrant, that's a big issue for me. But the idea is that when someone calls me on the phone and asks for my opinion, they're getting my opinion. And that puts me squarely at the center of my opinion. So I don't offer anything other than what I'm capable of offering, which is from my perspective. What do we know about my perspective? It's selfish, but it can also be really wrong. I think the biggest problem, and by the way, if you want to test this out, just walk into the sanctuary on a Sunday morning and listen to what people say. It is so cold in here. It is so stuffy in here. I have yet to find a setting on the thermostat that satisfies both ends of the spectrum. I have tried. It doesn't seem to be happening. Why do we do that? Because from our perspective, that's the first thing that greets us. That's what hits us. This is how it impacts me. And my opinion is we need to do something about it. Whenever you hear someone say we need to do something about it, they're probably having a bad experience. Our natural orientation. So, at a new job, I am over these people and under this person. I need to be oriented to that. Why do I need to be told in a new job who I am over and who I am under? Why is that important? What's going to happen if I'm not told who I'm over and who I'm under in a new job? Yeah, I might start doing things that I'm not authorized to do. Why? Because that's how I'm oriented. If I see something that needs to be done, I'm going to do it. If I see an issue, I'm going to deal with it. Whoa, that's not yours to deal with. Oh, I need to be oriented. That's why when someone starts a new job, we have this thing that we call orientation. It's like, yeah, don't touch the thermostat. I'm in charge of this and I'm not in charge of that. If I fail, this is what I will experience, but I won't experience that. Orientation. It's, I know what to expect. I know how to view this. I'm on the same ground. This is my perspective. When I'm flying a plane, realizing the special orientation of the plane has to do with equilibrium and balance. A little bit important when you're flying a plane to understand about orientation. That's why in most planes, and I'm not a pilot, but in most planes, they have this thing called the artificial horizon, which basically says this is what the horizon looks like, and this is how to keep the plane flying level. Why? Why is that a problem? Because sometimes when people fly into a storm or they fly into clouds, it is possible for them to come out of the cloud flying upside down and not even being aware of it. Orientation. Because of the natural effect of sin, we have a natural orientation toward our world. I believe this is universal. You can fight with me, but I believe we're universal. And that is this. Here's my natural orientation toward the world. I'm right. That's my natural orientation toward the world. I'm right. You feel that way. Anybody that's been married for more than 5 minutes, you know that. Here's another one. You're not going to like this one as much. I'm superior. Anybody who has ever said, why don't those knuckleheads in Washington, D.C. just fill in the blank? That flows out of a superior mindset. I have no idea what's involved in getting things done in Washington, D.C. And yet, for some reason, I feel very superior in being able to say, it would be simple. If I were there, it'd be simple. By the way, anybody running for president, this is a must. Why would you ever elect someone who doesn't feel superior? I can fix this. I can take care of it. It's our natural orientation toward the world. In a study done at Cornell University, 94% of professors at Cornell evaluated themselves to be above average IQ. The majority of drivers polled in the United States established their driving skills as being above normal. Think about that. We're all driving around thinking that we're a better driver than the other guy on the road. That is our natural orientation toward our world. We are good. That's another one. We have no need to change. Whoa! No need to change. And we encounter a God who says, I want you to grow, I want you to change, I want you to become more like me, less like you, more like me. Our natural position is, I have no need for that. I'm already good. I encounter God thinking, God, there may be something come up that I would need your help with, but fundamentally, I'm okay. So I don't need you to do anything. We can handle things on our own. That's our fundamental approach. I can do this. That's our natural orientation. Politically, we embrace one philosophy over another because we believe that philosophy will benefit us or others. Foreign aid polls very poorly because it is not perceived as benefiting us. Why do we send all this money to other countries when we have so many needs here? That doesn't poll well. The tiger mom gets upset when her daughter's name is mispronounced during the honors award. But other children's names were mispronounced as well. I don't care so much about that. And you're coming from a parent who had a kid named Josiah. He was Joshua 1 year. I forget what other years. It was like, this is outrageous. We're going to write a letter. I had no idea whether some of the Chinese students' names were pronounced correctly because I don't know how to pronounce them myself to evaluate that. Never mind that. It's my son's name that I'm concerned about. I pray for a sunny and warm day because there's a softball game today. What about the farmer whose livelihood depends on rain for his crops? Don't care so much about that. I pray for healing. Why? Because I want to feel better. But what about the lessons that God may want to teach me in pain? That's not my natural orientation. So I have this way of approaching the world around me. And the biggest issue in the orientation phase is that we are unaware of what's going on in our own soul. We are easily deceived without ever even realizing it. That's my natural posture. That's just how I come at the world. Our ability to evaluate others is solid. It is evaluating ourselves that seems to be our glaring weakness. My inability to see what's going on in my own soul can blind me. It manifests itself in marriage. As a long-term marriage counselor, I can tell you that most spouses delight in coming in and telling me all that is wrong with the other person. The other person. That's the real problem. And even if it is 90-10, there's a reluctance to deal with the 10 that is my piece, and there's more of an emphasis on the 90 that is the other person's. It manifests itself in vocation. I can't tell you how many times I have heard people say, I've got this idiot boss. Now, why do they feel like their boss is an idiot? Can there really be that many idiot bosses out there? Maybe so. The truth is, it's born out of my sense of being superior. If I were the boss, I would do it differently. We lived this out when my son Michael was in food management for a while. He had a manager over him, and he was constantly criticizing this manager. Never ordered enough food. Never ordered enough food. We're running out of stuff. We're running out of ketchup. We're running out of food. We never have enough. And then he got to dangle his feet in the water of management, and he discovered that you have to guess many times and that you don't want to order stuff that's going to go bad and that you've got to pay for, and that doesn't do well with that manager's boss. And he suddenly became a little more reasonable about it. But in the early days, it was constantly criticizing the manager. Why is this manager not doing their job well? And it manifests itself in godliness. My natural orientation is that I don't need to change. And I can talk to you all day about the other people who need to change, but not me. So that is orientation. Very quickly. We won't get through this, but I just want to start this. Our relative positioning begins to break down. Our relative positioning begins to break down. This way of viewing the world doesn't work well. Can you imagine? Always blaming other people for what's wrong with them and not taking ownership of what's wrong with me. always seeing that I could do better than someone else, superior, I don't need to change, I could do a better job. Can you imagine why? I don't get it. But our relative positioning begins to break down, and our natural orientation toward our world doesn't produce good results. The person who says, I'm just going to take a little of this drug, I can handle it. That sense of superiority produces an enslavement to the drug. All along going, I have no problem, I can do this, natural orientation, produces a disorientation that says, you're not all that. You can't handle that. You can't do all the things that you aspire to do. And things begin to break down. That's disorientation. Something isn't right. This isn't working anymore. This is getting harder. I'm losing control. And unrest produces strong emotional responses. We'll talk more about that next week. We have just a couple minutes. I dumped a lot of information on you today. Questions? Anything that you want to throw back? Right.
But the problem with that is that it's kind of the idea that list is that in the ultimate sense and in the ultimate ways that it really can't.
Right.
But if we bought into the lie that we can, that causes a huge problem, especially the way we orient to people, the way we relate to people who are not successful.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm. Right. That's a good point. Which is what we do. I think your point is well taken, that ultimately, even if we appear successful, it's still a house of cards, because ultimately God says everything's going to be subject to fire and only what is of eternal value is going to emerge. So I can be juggling three things at the same time and say, look, I can do this, but there's coming a day when, not because I can't handle it, but because God is going to take it away. Best illustration of that. If you were a Jew living in the first century, what was at the center of your worship? The temple. It was all about the temple. That was the centerpiece. It wasn't God, it was the temple that they worshiped. And God knew that. And so what was the one thing that God went out of his way to take away from them? The temple. Brick by brick. AD 70, gone, leveled. And Jesus said, you are treating this place as if it's yours. It's not. It belongs to my Father. This isn't your life. And so God took away from them the center. Now, he never stopped being the center of worship, but he took away what they had said. We can do this. So, excellent point. Excellent point. All right, we'll pick up there next week. Thank you for your kind attention.